equilibrium and isotropy, then we got a starting point also for the velocity distribution of dark matters being Maxwell-Boltzmann. And then we thought a little bit about results coming from n-body simulations, which show deviations from both our starting assumptions from the rotation curves, both the density as well as the velocity distribution. So in the lecture now, what I want to do is something similar, except on assumptions about the dark matter mass and production. So again, we're going to start off with kind of where we look under the lamppost, the basic, most kind of common, simple assumptions about the dark matter mass. And then we'll also discuss a little bit about how we can move away from those basic assumptions. All right, so when it comes to the dark matter mass, we aren't very constrained. It can fall anywhere in a range roughly going from 10 to the minus 22 EV all the way up to 10 to the 59 EV. So really a lot of room there. Where these are coming from is the lower bound here comes from assuming that taking the limit where the dark matter is just a super ultra light boson. And we assume it's so light that we can effectively treat it as acting like a field. It is so light that it is essentially acting as a classical field. And then we just need to ask, in order for us to have stability, how light can we drive it such that we still end up having stabilities, the stability of a dark matter halo? This is very similar to asking in quantum mechanics, for example, if I can treat the electron like a wave, use the uncertainty principle to tell me the stability of just the hydrogen atom. It can do the same thing in this limit where the dark matter is so light it's acting like a classical field. And in order to have the stability, the mass has to be roughly 10 to the minus 22 EV. So that's where that lower bound is coming from. The upper bound here comes from searches of compact halo objects. So these would just be like, exactly what the name says, just like chunks of, very big blocks of kind of like, well, the dark matter particle would just be like some kind of massive-ish type object. And in that case, we get these limits from lensing. So the fact that, from microlensing, and so the limits from that is this upper bound of 10 to the 59. So, which such a huge range, yes?
Is there a problem with it being greater than the Planck scale? So, is it something that it's composite or something? Like, I'm just wondering how this can be even a feasible mass for the dark matter. Is it not an elementary particle? Is that the assumption? Like, I thought that the Planck scale was the fundamental bound for any sort of dark matter, any sort of particle that you can think of.
Did the world of black hole, for example?
Yeah.
So black hole dark matter candidate, that's what you mean. Okay.
All right. Okay, so given this very, very, very broad range, we're gonna want to try to narrow it down to some starting point that we think is the right place to start looking. And the picture that, you know, you may have even already seen this in talks that people often refer to is the Wimp miracle. And I'm going to put this in quotations. We'll come back to that. Which says that very roughly the dark matter mass would be, these are all tildes, keep that in mind, 100 GeV-ish, so weak scale dark matter with weak scale interaction, weakly interacting dark matter, roughly 100 GeV. And what I want to do now is just kind of outline the argument behind this so that you can see why this particular mass range is well motivated, and also why, I mean, understanding this is really critical for understanding some of the primary types of dark matter experiments currently ongoing, because they've kind of been really targeting this mass range. So the general picture here is that in the early universe, dark matter is zipping about. Every now and then it finds another dark matter particle, it annihilates into standard model particles, and this whole thing is in equilibrium. But as time progresses, the universe is expanding. After a certain point, the dark matter particles can't find each other anymore, and so they can't annihilate. The equilibrium is broken, and their density freezes out. And the density at the time of freeze out corresponds to the density that we observe today. So let's just kind of do the calculation to actually see what this gives. So this freeze-out process is described by the Boltzmann equation. Specifically, the following. Okay, so N here is the dark matter number density. A is the scale factor. Sigma V is this is velocity, relative velocity of the dark matter, the cross section, so thermally averaged annihilation cross section. All right, N is the number density, and with the subscript EQ, that's the equilibrium number density. So pretty much this equation is going to just describe how the number density for the dark matter evolves as a function of time. And we'll have an easier time kind of pulling physics out of it if we just rewrite it in terms of some different variables. So specifically, I'm going to define a variable capital Y that's going to be the number density divided by the temperature cubed. And then similarly, Y with EQ is just going to be equilibrium number density divided by T cubed. And if we make the substitution up there, what we'd find is the following. And the last substitution that I want to make is just to redefine a new time variable. So I'm going to define X as being mass over temperature. And let's see, so this gave me that. If I make this redefinition, then I can rewrite the Boltzmann equation as follows. where lambda is going, I mean, it's just a constant, but this is what it depends on, mass cubed, annihilation cross-section, and then Hubble. So equations of this form are known as, I'm going to spell this right. No, it's only one T. Riccati equations. They don't have a simple analytic form. So you can do this all out numerically. But what I want to do here is just take it in some limits so that we can see what the generic behavior is of the solution. Yeah?
Sorry, question. Did you also define T, like time equals 1 over temperature?
Yes. All right, so in the limit where the annihilation rate is much greater than the expansion rate, so we're going to start off in this limit. In this limit, lambda is going to be quite large, and so what you end up getting is that y, which remember is just our number density divided by temperature cubed, is going to just track its equilibrium value. Let's see. I think I'll sketch it out on this board here. Okay, so the equilibrium. The expectation for the equilibrium value is going to look something like this, just exponentially falling. So in the limit where the annihilation rate is going to be much greater than the Hubble rate, we're here, and we're just going to follow this. Well, I'm going to label this equilibrium. We're just going to follow this. So we're just going to kind of continue along here, following exactly, right? Now, at some point, we're going to deviate, because at some point, we're going to have the fact that the annihilation rate's going to be much smaller than the expansion rate. In this limit, the equation looks as follows. So dy dx goes as minus lambda y squared over x squared. Okay, it's just in this limit, which we can solve this exactly. And what we find is the following. My mind again. Okay. So 1 over the value of y at infinity minus 1 over the value at this time, which I'm going to call freeze out and label by a subscript f, is going to be roughly lambda over x at freeze out. And this very roughly gives us the following. So what this tells us is that once the Hubble expansion rate is much greater than the annihilation rate, this y here, number density over temperature cubed, is just some constant. So While before, all I was doing was just kind of tracking the equilibrium expectation, at some point, this tells us that we break off and the value of y is just a constant. And it's going to remain constant until today. So the number density essentially at freeze-out, this point in time here, is called freeze-out for obvious reasons, because this is the number density doesn't change beyond this point. So whatever the number density is here at freeze-out is the number density that we observe today. All right, so as first exercise for the afternoon, I want you to just sketch out what happens to this freeze-out value . So sketch y as the annihilation rate increases relative to what I've sketched and decreases just relative to this value. Okay, so, I've drawn another line, multiple choice, two possibilities, votes for A, okay, votes for B, unanimous. Okay, good, that's great. So this is what we would expect if the annihilation cross-section increases. So intuitively, this is just telling us that if the annihilation rate is larger, it's going to annihilate more, so we'll be left with less dark matter than we'll observe today. All right, so once we do this whole freeze-out process, we can get the number density here at freeze-out. We can convert that to the observed density for the dark matter today. And that is going to be the following. I won't bore you with the, I'll just give you the final answer. So very roughly, I can write this as follows. 0.1 picobarns over the thermally averaged annihilation cross-section, which I can also write as follows. I'm going to break this up into the constants that feed into this annihilation cross-section. So there's a coupling constant, alpha, and then there's the dark matter mass. And I wrote it in a somewhat leading way, because This has been measured by Planck, WMAP, right? And the measured value is 0.1199 plus or minus 0.0027. So this tells us that if I have a coupling that's roughly on the order of weak scale coupling and dark matter mass that's roughly around 100 GeV, I'll pretty much end up nailing the dark matter density today. The freeze-out process would just end up giving me the right, automatically gives me the right density. So the fact that this seems to happen miraculously is what's often called the Wimp miracle. So this is just the fact that we only need weakly interacting dark matter and we get the right, we can predict the right density today. So in this framework, we can actually, it really decreases the range of masses that we'd want to consider for dark matter. So in particular then, in this case, the lower bound really is going to be more like M chi has to be greater than around KeV-ish. Right? Where this lower bound is coming from, this is the warm dark matter constraint, essentially. And the upper bound here, and sorry, both this lower bound and this upper bound are specific to the case of dark matter that was initially in thermal equilibrium and freezes out, okay? And then the upper bound in this case is roughly on the order of 100 TeV. And this comes from the fact, this just comes from partial wave unitarity. Unitarity constraints on the cross section. So we can't make the cross section arbitrarily large. Are there questions on this? Yeah? Oh. So let's see. Yeah, so there's general constraints that you can write down for cross sections in general that you need them to be unitary. And so that usually that constrains the dependence of the cross section on the mass of the dark matter. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I think in this case it constrains this to fall off roughly like that. And so it just means that the cross section can't become arbitrarily large, because if it does, then you break unitarity, then it's not consistent. So similar type of unitarity arguments were used, let's say, for Higgs, right? To, if the Higgs weren't there, then WW scattering would blow up or something like that. Yeah?
How do you get two bounds? I thought you'd get one, like a lower bound or upper bound.
How you get two bounds for what? They're two separate bounds.
Right, but the unitarity constraint would give you one bound. It would say that the cross section does not exceed one. And scattering cross section does not exceed one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That would give you one bound.
Yes, that's this one.
And how do you get the lower bound?
Oh, the lower bound just comes from structure constraints. This is the warm dark matter. This is just saying that you can't have hot dark matter.
Oh.
Yeah. This one?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, the dynamics of that dark matter particle are totally different, because there we're treating it like it's effectively almost like a fluid. It's like a classical field. So it's not in thermal equilibrium, and the cosmology is totally different. And the stability of the halos in that case is coming just from essentially the wave nature of the dark matter particle, which is different than this. Okay, so yeah, kind of totally different mechanism at play. The cosmology is very different. Yeah. So this WIMP paradigm has really guided a lot of dark matter theory for many, many years. If we are going to start looking under the lamppost, this is a nice lamppost to start looking under because we have a lot of experiments, like the LHC, that are going to be sensitive to precisely this kind of range of masses. But how much of a miracle is this really? So simply looking at this, can you think of, I mean, I wrote it in a very leading fashion here to kind of point you to this WIMP miracle, but can you see a way of evading this? How can, is there some way that I can drive the mass of the dark matter lower, for example? Yeah, right. So, you know, one example is the case where we drive alpha to be much smaller than 1, but we keep this ratio, alpha squared over m squared, to still be fixed. These types of models called WIMPless models, if you want to reference Feng and Kumar, 4196. Another way that we can evade this is to say that the relic density is set by 3 to 2 annihilations, rather than 2 to 2. So everything I've shown you so far was just kind of assuming 2 to 2 annihilations. What this ends up necessitating, if you make this assumption that you could have 3 to 2 annihilations, is it actually ends up requiring that the dark matter mass be lower in order for you to reach getting the right, in order for you to freeze out at the right relic density. So this tends to give predict lighter dark masses. And specifically, it tends to predict masses that are roughly around the GeV-ish scale. Okay. So there was some work on this here, Carlson, Matichak, and Hall. And then most recently, there was a series of paper by Hochberg et al. They call these types of scenarios strongly interactive massic particles, or SIMPs. So just a little spin off of the WIMP. Okay, here's another scenario. I'm just going to list a few examples. I mean, there's a whole literature on this. But just to kind of give you a flavor that this isn't that much of a miracle, and it's important to be thinking broadly. There's a class of models called asymmetric dark matter. In these types of models, you actually use a whole different type of motivator for what's setting the dark matter mass. So in this case, we were using this whole freeze-out picture, right? In asymmetric dark matter, you make the assumption that the dark matter density is essentially related to the baryon density. So we know from measurement that the dark matter density relative to the baryonic density is roughly 5. At this stage, we don't really know why, but essentially the, you know, in asymmetric dark matter models, you use this as the motivator for trying to set the dark matter mass, okay? And so essentially in this case, what ends up happening is that the dark matter masses tend to prefer, the dark matter masses tend to be about 5 times the mass of the proton. So typically these models tend to give you dark matter masses that are in the GeV-ish range. Again, lighter than you would otherwise expect from the Whip miracle. So these papers, let's see, these ideas were first 1985, and then Nusanov, and then more recently, sort of the whole name of asymmetric dark matter started with paper by Kaplan, Ludi, and Zurich. This was in 2009. So with all of those caveats about how this is not that much of a miracle, et cetera, and I want you to keep those all in mind because I think it's very important, I did want to give you a case study of a model that actually does give us a thermal relic according to this freeze-out picture. And so the case study that we're going to look at briefly is the case of the SUSY neutralino. So this is kind of like a very natural, standard WIMP candidate. I think in many ways, it served as a huge impetus for giving a lot of strength to the WIMP miracle argument, because now you have this, you know, whole framework of supersymmetry that's motivated for other reasons in addition to dark matter. And hey, look, it also ends up giving us a WIMP candidate, as we might expect from these very simple arguments. So it was a very, very nice, well-contained type of picture. Now, I don't have time today to do a very broad overview of SUSY. I think I spoke with Natalia. She said she will give you a very nice overview. So all I'm going to do is sort of pick out the most relevant bits for trying to explain SUSY neutralinos. So that we can focus on that here, and then you'll kind of get the broader framework with Natalia in a day or two. So how many people are like comfortable with SUSY? Or thought a little bit about SUSY? Have heard of the word SUSY? Okay. okay, so very, very, very generally, and again, you'll get the more detailed picture from Natalia. Supersymmetry is essentially a symmetry that relates bosons and fermions. So for every standard model particle that we know of, it's going to have its SUSY partner, which will be the same in terms of charges and quantum numbers, but it will differ in its spin. So the particular particles that are going to be of relevance for us in order to understand the SUSY neutralino are the following ones. So we have our gauge bosons, standard model gauge bosons, the FE2 gauge bosons. They're going to have a SUSY partner. Those SUSY partners are referred to as WINOs. The SUSY partners are going to have spin 1/2 and are typically denoted with tildes on top. Similarly, in the standard model, we have our U1 gauge boson, so I'll call that the B boson, and then its super partner is just going to be a B with a tilde on it, and we'll refer to that as a Bino. Okay. Now I'm also going to add some scalars to this list. So I can have, well, so in SUSY models, we typically have two Higgs bosons. So we'll have an H up charged and an H up neutral. And then similarly, the down charged. charged and the down neutral. So it's a two Higgs doublet model. And then similarly, we have their spin one partners. So we call these the Higgs, right, standard model states, and then these super partners are referred to as Higgsinos. So after electroweak symmetry breaking in SUSY models, you end up getting mixing between these different states. And so in particular, the neutral guys will mix together, and the charged guys also mix together. So we get mixing. Electroweak symmetry breaking. So this means that I can effectively group the states that mix together. So in the gauge eigenstate basis, I can write down a state psi naught, which is going to just be the neutral components of these super partners. And in the neutralino part of the Lagrangian, I'd end up with a mass term that looks like this, where this is just a mass matrix, and it's not necessarily diagonal. So if we wanted to describe the states in terms of their mass eigenstates, then we'd want to diagonalize this mass matrix and redefine our rewrite everything in the mass eigenstate basis. And so in this basis, we call the particles that we get, so which are just going to be mixtures of these neutral super partners. These are neutralinos, okay? And they are just linear combinations of the Bino, the Weino, and the Higgsinos, the neutral components. So the neutralino doesn't have any charge to it. There's actually four of them, right, which I'm going to get because this is a 4x4 matrix. So when I diagonalize, I'm going to get four of them. And then each one is a different combination of the original states. I can repeat the same process with the charged guys here, the charged Weino and the charged Higgsino, they also will mix together. And in that mass basis, then these guys are referred to as chargenos. So the chargenos are just linear combinations of the charged components. So now the question is, well, you know, why do we care? Why is the neutralino an interesting dark matter candidate? And the reason is that if we introduce the following, R parity. So I'm going to give you the rule for R parity, and then I'm going to want you to spend a few minutes just kind of thinking about what the phenomenological implications are. So the rules for R parity are the following. All standard model particles have R parity of plus 1. And then all the Susie partners, all Susie particles have R parity of minus 1. So as an exercise, spend the next few minutes discussing amongst yourselves what the implications of R parity are. And in particular, focus on a few things. One is, what are the implications for colliders? For example, how many superparticles can I produce in any interaction? And then also, what are the implications for the neutralino sector? Are these neutralinos stable? Are they not stable? Et cetera, et cetera. So spend 3 or 4 minutes, maybe 5, kind of trying to work through what the implications of R parity are for the model. So the conversation seems to kind of be, volume seems to be whittling down a little bit. So based off of your discussions, right, if I have any interaction vertex that includes both standard model and Susie particles, how many Susie particles must there be? Even number. Good. Yeah. So, I mean, if I draw something, right, I mean, if I have an interaction vertex like this, I must have two R parity minus one particles in order for R parity to be conserved by that vertex, right? And what are the implications of this for the neutralino? Yeah.
If it's the lightest Susie partner, it's
Yes, that's right. So precisely because of this result, this means that if the neutralino is the lightest particle, it has to be stable, because if I have the neutralino here, it's the lightest one, it can't, it, you know, it by this rule, the only interactions that are allowed is one where it would also go to another Suzy particle and then to a standard model particle. But if it's the lightest one, then it can't actually decay to another Suzy particle, right? So it has, it's just going to be stable, right? And this is ideal, right? Because now I have a neutral particle that is stable. And turns out, I'm going to just say, we'll go over this in a little bit, but turns out it also gives you the right relic density. So it's kind of beautiful. I mean, it just kind of fits what you'd want it to do as a dark matter particle. Actually, let's just jump into that. So we won't actually calculate out the relic abundance for the different Suzy particles in detail, because that would be pretty tedious. But I did want to give you a sense for what masses of neutralinos tend to give you the right relic abundance. So let's say I'm going to hash this in here as roughly the allowed range by experiment. So this is, my mic came undone. Okay, so this is just the measured value of the relic abundance with some error bar around it. So we want something to fall in this shaded band. If the neutralino is a pure beno, so remember, I mean, it's a mixture, right? But I'm going to take the limit where it's 100% beno. We very roughly expect its mass, so in order to get the right relic abundance for pure beno dark matter, the mass needs to be below 100 GeV, but pretty close to it. Now, what this requires is that the demands, actually, that the super partners for the electrons be light. And this is excluded by LEP. So said another way, in order to get the right relic abundance for pure beno dark matter, I can get it to, you know, it is roughly, can be roughly 100 GeV in mass, but it does require that another superparticle, the partner for the electron, also be light. If this guy were light, it should have been produced fairly copiously by LEP. We haven't seen it. So this window for just having pure beno dark matter is pretty much ruled out. I mean, there still might be some corners of parameter space, but it's very, very, very tightly constrained. Yeah?
How does it imply that the
superparticle? So if you calculate out the annihilation, so right, in order to get this, you need to find the annihilation cross-section for the beno. And so this cross-section depends on the mass of the electron, the partner of the superpartner for the electron. And so in order for this to all work, that ends up having to be light. Okay, so if the neutralino were pure weno, so all of it's in the W with the squiggle, then this looks more like the following. I'm going to move this over a little bit. There we go. So if it's pure weno, it gives us the right relic abundance. If the mass of the weno is roughly on the order of 3 TeV. So, you know, a little bit heavier than the 100 GeV range, but kind of still in spitting distance. If the neutralino were pure Higgsino, this would look more like this. So the mass would be more like a TeV in order to get the correct relic abundance. So one thing you can see immediately from this is that for pure states, so for the pure Beano, pure Higgsino, pure Wino, we actually can't get a 100 GeV candidate that simultaneously gives us the right dark matter abundance. And so in order to get a 100 GeV neutralino that gives the right relic density, you need mixtures of the states. Which you can get. It's just important to kind of keep in mind that this requires mixed neutralinos. Yep.
Like naively, I would expect anywhere from what looks like around 10 GeV, or I don't know, like 30 GeV to 1,000 GeV, or 3 TeV. Like you can pretty well fit that whole window just by averaging.
Yeah. If you mix them together, then yeah, you can fill in the region. There will be certain of those mixtures that will be excluded for other reasons, from other searches. So there's that you need to pull in. But yeah, by mixing them all up, you end up filling in the region in between. Yeah.
Are the other pure states mostly excluded as well?
Which the would you, like this, these ones?
No, like having like a pure Higgsino, a pure Wino, neutralino, like is that?
Are these dark? Like, is a pure Higgsino and pure Wino, are those actually excluded by other experiments?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Really good question. So I'm going to come back to that tomorrow. The quick answer is no, and maybe. So the reason why this is maybe is, actually, this is really cool. I'll give you the general outline of the argument, and then we'll do it in a lot of detail tomorrow. But the exclusions from this is too heavy to be produced at the LHC. You wouldn't see it at the LHC. Also, it would give you no direct detection signal, so the scattering rate off of nuclei is really small, so you wouldn't see it that way. So the one way you could potentially see it is it annihilating to W bosons or photons in just the galaxy, and you look for these annihilation products. So those are these indirect detection experiments. It turns out that the annihilation cross-section for the Wino isn't that large, except for the fact that you get this really weird enhancement from non-relativistic effects, which we're going to discuss tomorrow, that gives you a spike in the annihilation rate, and it's because of that spike that you can almost exclude it with Cherenkov telescopes. It's actually excluded for the most standard types of dark matter profiles, you assume, and you would need a pretty strange profile in order for this to still be allowed. Well, we'll go through. I'll show you plots and everything tomorrow, but so hopefully that'll make more sense then. But it's actually pretty cool. We're almost at a point of totally excluding this one. Said another way, oftentimes you end up seeing these plots for, let's say, direct detection experiments, which are looking for the scattering off of nuclei, and they're designed to have maximum sensitivity at 100 GeV. And I think it's really important to just keep in mind that, yeah, I mean, precisely what you said, it's actually not that special, so we do need to be thinking broadly, right? Because you can end up having thermal relics that are heavier than that. Yeah.
Is the strength of the coupling of these two GeV vertices the same as the
GeV? I mean, it's close-ish. Yeah, close-ish, yeah.
Is Susie Brigham, at this stage, or not Susie Brigham?
Is what? Sorry?
Susie
Oh, this is assuming, yeah. So I kind of glossed over that because I'm hoping that Natalia is going to go over it. But yeah, this is assuming that Suzy is broken. Yeah.
So the way you include a Gluino in the method.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Because the Gluino is charged under SU3, so it won't mix with these guys. Yeah. So these all have the same. They have to have the same quantum numbers to be able to mix, right? So the Gluino is going to have SU3 charge. So yeah. Oh no, this still holds even when you have Suzy breaking. Yeah. More questions, yeah. No, that's good.
What's the question is we send over the important polymorphic? Because you mentioned that Neutralino is very interesting for you because that's very stable and also in the lightest part.
Yeah.
That's true in MSSM. But in GMSM, gravity is the lightest.
Yeah.
Neutralino is not very interesting. Is it scenario important for the model or not?
It is. I mean, you can have, like you said, gravitino dark matter. I've only focused on the neutralino case because it's one of the, just as an example, like I said, case study. But yeah, there's a lot more. Just even within supersymmetry, you can have other, like the gravitino. Yes. Oh, it's very different with gravitino dark matter. It's very light, and so the cosmology and things can change. So yeah. The other reason why I chose specifically to kind of highlight the neutralino is because tomorrow when we get to the experimental searches, again, like I said before, a lot of them are kind of targeting this region. So I wanted you to have this framework in the back of your mind just so that you kind of understood the motivation for those searches. But yeah, you're right. Even just within SUSY, you can also have different dark matter. Yeah?
So were the direct detection instruments even probe with TV candidates, or were they not sensitive to that at all?
Direct detection?
Yeah.
No, they do have sensitivity to TEV candidates. Yeah, it's weaker than their sensitivity to so we'll see this tomorrow. But usually they present their limits like this, right? Cross section with the scattering cross section with the nuclei and the mass of the dark matter, and usually it looks like this, where this best sensitivity is roughly around 100 or 50 GeV. But they do have sensitivity to the TEV range. It's just not quite as strong. Okay, so that took a little bit longer than I thought it was going to take. When's the next, Itai? When's the next? There is no time. Okay. Okay. Okay, they all start be like collapsing from fatigue. All right, so there's one more thing I wanted to discuss. I don't want you to collapse from fatigue, so I'm going to do this kind of heuristically, just as we'll do it in pictures, so we'll keep it light and fresh. All right, so the last example I wanted to give was a scenario where you can get the right dark matter abundance, but not from thermal freeze out. And so there's, again, like a wide variety of scenarios for things like that, but I just want to choose one example and give it to you so that you can have a specific thing in mind. So the case study that I wanted to introduce was that of the QCD axion, just because it's such a classic example. So this is going to be an example of non-thermal dark matter production. It's also a very nice counterpoint to the standard WIMP paradigm because the masses you expect for the QCD axion are drastically different, and also the way it couples to the standard model is drastically different. So the types of searches you would do for a QCD axion are very, very different than the types of searches you would do for a WIMP. All right, so keeping this not too heavy. So in the QCD Lagrangian, we get a term that's often referred to as the theta term. It looks like the following. So the capital G's here are the gluon field strengths. And when I write this with the tilde on it, now we're switching over notation, so this is not super partner. It means the following. So there's an epsilon tensor here. There we go. So this term in the QCD Lagrangian violates CP, and it predicts that the neutron should have an electric dipole moment. That is roughly on the okay, so this is the strength of the electric dipole moment that you would expect, the contribution coming from this term here. Now, the trouble is that we can actually go measure this very precisely. And when we do that, we can put a limit on what theta is, how large theta can be. And what we find from experiment is that theta has to be less than 10 to the minus 10. So this is a super teeny tiny number, and the question is, why should it be this small? Why is it there at all? What's keeping it this small? It's a separate kind of fine-tuning issue in the same way that we have fine-tuning issues for Higgs mass, et cetera, et cetera. And this is oftentimes referred to as the strong CP problem. Okay, so one way to resolve this is to develop, we want some kind of dynamical mechanism that works to keep theta small. And one way to achieve this is by promoting theta to a field. So we promote theta to a field A, where A is this is an axion field, and all this is just some constant, which I'm going to come back to in a little bit. And we say that the potential is minimized when A is zero. So there's going to be some mechanism that's going to drive this field down to zero. And in doing so, it will drive down the value of theta to a small number, and thus explain why it's so small. All right, so let's see. Let's do this step by step and in pictures. So I just want to explain this in a little bit more detail. So at step one is going to be at very high energies. We're going to introduce a field, complex scalar field phi. That's going to be charged under U1 symmetry. I'm going to call it the Pecci-Quinn symmetry, so PQ subscript. When the temperature is going to fall below some scale, and I'm going to call this scale F sub A. So when the temperature falls below F sub A, then we're going to essentially have some kind of symmetry breaking effect. And the potential is going to look like I'm not going to have enough space here. All right, let me move to this board. All right, so when the temperature falls below F sub A, our potential is going to look as follows. Let's see if I can draw this. Okay, so this is the potential that we started with. So when temperature falls below F sub A, this is going to be the imaginary component of phi. This is the real component of phi. We break, the vacuum breaks, and so we end up with our Mexican, like a Mexican hat potential. And we have 1 degree of freedom here that's left, and that's the phase of the field, right? It's unconstrained. It can fall anywhere in this region, right? If I had a ball roll down here, it could roll around and around and around in the base of this potential, and it would be fine, right? And so this degree of freedom that's left after the symmetry breaking is essentially the axion, okay? So said another way, the axion is just the pseudo-Goldstone boson that's left after the symmetry breaking. At this point in time, the axion is massless. But once the temperature hits that of the QCD confinement scale, then there's QCD instanton effects that actually give the axion a mass. And what this looks like in pictures is I'm going to take this potential, and it's going to tilt. All right, this is going to kind of test my drawing abilities. But OK, Mexican hat potential, but now tilted, OK? And the tilt is coming from the fact that the axion now has a mass.
How
is
the axion covered in the standard model?
Ah, yes. Can I come back to that a little bit? Yeah, I'll come back to that. All right, so now we have our tilted potential.
Can you write down the charges of the field then?
The charges of which fields?
All the fields? Like the standard model, like field, do they charge under the effective symmetry? Is the axion charged under the effective? Sorry, is the.
Well, the phi is charged under the Petri-Clipp symmetry.
And nothing else?
And then it breaks. Well, no, you do get couplings between this axion and the standard. I'm going to push that off just first because I want to finish this line of thought. But then I'll draw the diagrams of the allowed interactions between the axion and the standard model fields. Okay, good. So now we have this tilted potential. So initially, is there some preferred value for theta? No, right? So I can start here, I can start there, I can start there. There is no initial preferred value for theta. Let's do this. All values of theta are allowed. So the question is going to be, what happens you know, so randomly some value of theta is gonna, it's kind of, we can just have some random choice of theta initially. And that'll be essentially where the field starts off. And what's gonna happen as a function of time? So I start off the field at some arbitrary value of theta, let's say here, right? What's going to happen with time? Yeah, so it's gonna roll down, right? And what I want you to just sketch out now is how you think the value, I lost my eraser. Oh, it's up here. Yeah, they're rolling down. All right. Yeah, so what I want you to sketch out now is how this value of theta changes as a function of time. So specifically, can you sketch out what the following would look like? So this is time. This is the value of theta over some, whatever its arbitrary initial value is, right? That's just some random value. So what would this look like as a function of time? Call out ideas.
A decaying oscillation.
A decaying oscillation. So, like that.
It will become negative also. I assume it's kind of oscillating around the bottom, so it can become negative also.
Yeah. Like that. This is what you had in mind? Complaints?
It shouldn't be oscillating all the way down, right? It should just roll down.
So you want it to be what? What's it initially?
It should initially be 1.
It should initially be 1. Okay, and then what?
It should decay down to 0.
Decay.
And then it should hit, right? So it'll get past 0, and it'll be like a damped oscillation.
And then this. Okay. I think I have more colored chalk. More ideas? Purple. Who's going to want a purple?
Start oscillating first, and then the amplitude of the oscillation is decaying.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Yeah. All right. So, all right. I can change your line. All right. So big, and then kind of getting smaller, like that. Okay. More thoughts? It should just. You want it this. No. Oh, like this.
It depends on the description.
Yes, no, this is good. This is good. All right. So, the general essence is pretty much on target. Let me sketch out what it looks like. Okay. All right. So you guys had it right that it's kind of decaying. All right. It does start off flat here. So at very early times, it's just kind of constant, but then it starts falling off. The equation for motion for theta, and again, we don't have that much time today, so I'm just going to give this to you, but so that you can kind of see what's governing the dynamics of this motion is the following. Okay? So So yeah, this is what's giving you this kind of damped oscillating motion. But the really critical point of all of this is the fact that at the end of the day, the there's actually there's a density for the axion that's left over from this. This sort of is oscillating but approaching some value on average. And that average value for the energy density is the mass of the axion, which depends on temperature, divided by the scale factor cubed times a constant. And the really critical part is that this is just what we expect for non-relativistic matter, right? So this axion field reaches some density, some ultimate density, through a process that's totally different than thermal freeze out, right? This is, all in pictures, tilted potentials, things rolling back and forth, like really, really different. But at the end of the day, can end up giving you the right density that sort of scales as you would expect non-relativistic matter to scale. And that's the reason why axion dark matter can actually act as a nice cold dark matter candidate. Okay? Are there questions? Yeah?
Is this energy density coming from a vacuum misalignment or from?
Yeah, it's coming from this vacuum misalignment. It's coming from this process.
So should it be thought of as like a classical field or like a bunch of particles?
I would think of it as like a classical field, kind of just oscillating. Good question. So, all right, so here's the equation of motion, right? So when the temperature is much larger than lambda QCD, I guess that's not too fair. I didn't tell you what time to start your curve at. Yes, so when the temperature is much greater than lambda QCD, the mass is just zero, right? So that the potential is flat. It hasn't tilted yet. So that's why this is just flat, and then it tilts, and then that's when you start getting this oscillation. Yeah.
Is there also a regime where Hubble is sufficiently large that it's just like Hubble friction and stuff that's from, like, is the 3H term that's damping, right? Like that's a
mm-hmm.
So is there a point where it tilts, but the friction is so large that it can't?
Oh, that it just stops it?
That it just doesn't really roll until the friction becomes sufficiently weak.
Let's see. So I guess in that scenario, actually, whatever would end up happening wouldn't end up being, you wouldn't end up getting the density to be that of a cold dark matter candidate, right? Because you need this oscillation in order to get the right energy density. So I think what you're saying is feasible, it's just in that case it wouldn't be good.
No, wouldn't the friction eventually decrease if the universe, like the Hubble, as Hubble decreases?
The friction eventually, I think I see what you're saying, sure.
Yeah, it's not particularly well.
Yeah, I don't know. Michael, Itai, do you have any thoughts on that?
Oscillations in the regime that mass is bigger than h, then you get the oscillation. And before
yes.
That, it's a constant.
Yeah.
So h is like whatever in Planck. So it's small compared to the mass.
Isn't it like
T
squared over?
In large temperature, it's only a Hubble friction is dominating, and the last passing is moving independently of what you're doing. Because H is this square over M plus.
Yeah.
some point, it is, as you say, becoming subdominant.
But after the QCD, after
Yeah, okay.
So the QCD phase transition happens after that.
Yeah, long after, right? Like,
okay.
This Hubble becomes irrelevant compared to MA already early on because of M plus.
All right, so I was getting a bunch of questions while I was going through this, good questions about just how the axion couples to standard model particles. So because we don't have very much time left, I'm just going to just briefly kind of sketch this out, just so you have a sense for what the mass scales are that I'm talking about, what's allowed, what's not allowed, and what the interactions would be. So the axion mass is 6 times 10 to the minus 10 EV, and then depends on what this Petchy-Quinn scale is, okay? Let me show you how it couples to ordinary matter. I'm just going to sketch this. So it can couple to nucleons. Couples to electrons, leptons, okay? In both of these cases, these are derivative couplings. With a scale that's set by 1 over FA, so suppressed. You can also have the axion come in and then go to photons. This conversion is actually one of the dominant type, well, one of the primary ways to look for dark matter is to look for axion production in like really high magnetic fields. So that's kind of utilizing this. But like I said, these are pretty suppressed, both of these couplings. There are some dedicated searches for axions. Much of the parameter region is excluded from astrophysical searches, so it can act, the presence of axions can affect things like cooling rates of stars. And so in general, I'm just going to kind of, the following ranges are excluded from these laboratory and astrophysical searches. FA less than or about 10 to the 9 GeV, and also right around 10 to 11 GeV, there's a region. This is excluded. And again, this is just from a variety of these astrophysical searches. Okay, so that was kind of very whirlwind. We could have spent a whole, you know, one whole session just dedicated to doing axions, but I wanted to kind of briefly lay this out just as a counterexample to the WIMP scenario. You can see that the types of masses you're talking about here are much smaller than what you'd expect for WIMPs, but that it's still a good cold dark matter candidate. And you know, the types of couplings that you expect are also quite different, so the searches that you do would be very different. All right, so with that, I think I will conclude. Tomorrow we're going to focus on, in the morning, on direct detection experiments, and in the afternoon on indirect detection experiments. If there's any more questions on this, be happy to chat some more, or if you guys want a break, totally cool. So.
So we're pretty much done for today, except you see there's this little item in the schedule called exercises, 5:30. Now, we're not going to have any exercises, don't worry, you're done for today. But I do want to encourage you to spend some amount of your evening going over the material that you have encountered today. I mean, mean, there are a lot of people here. You can meet a lot of friends. It's better to do those things in groups. Meet a few people that you know and hang around for the evening. Get some dinner, get some tea or coffee, and sit down for an hour or two and just go over things that you encounter today and try to work things out together, or try to, demystify yourself on things that you hear about. There are really a fantastic number of locations you can do it. There are lots of blackboards. You can see almost in every nook around you there's a blackboard that you can work. So I do want to encourage you to take full advantage of the summer school, and that this exercise session is supposed to do that. But we're not going to enforce anything. It's completely up to you. You're all grown-ups. So your evening, that means your evenings are yours. All right. See you all tomorrow.